This is Functional Medicine Update for December 2009, Volume 29, Number 12. This special two-part edition of FMU will be a historical overview of orthomolecular and functional medicine. Part 1 will include the birth of orthomolecular medicine at the beginning of the last century, and the bulk of Part 1 of this issue will be an interview of Dr. Linus Pauling, recorded with Jeffrey Bland in 1982. Part 2 of this edition will feature a recent interview of Dr. Bland with Dr. Abram Hoffer shortly before his passing. Following this interview, Dr. Bland will be discussing the contributions of today's medicine by Drs. Pauling, Hoffer, and other contributing pioneers, including Dr. Roger Williams. Dr. Bland's comments will include how vitamin C functions as a therapeutic agent, why nutrition is for real people, and what the future holds for this new age of medicine. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the December 2009 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
I'd have to say this is an issue to remember for all of us. Never in the history of functional medicine, in its now nearly 28 years, have we had on the same issue two of the founding fathers of the whole concept of molecular medicine and functional medicine. You're going to be privileged to hear from the voices of two of the founding fathers, both unfortunately now deceased, who have made the extraordinary intellectual contributions to the birthing of our field. Dr. Linus Pauling, two-time Nobel Prize-winning laureate, in fact, still even today, the only person to have won two independent Nobel Prizes in two different fields, one in chemistry and the other in peace. And secondly, Dr. Abram Hoffer, MD, PhD, father of orthomolecular psychiatry, and obviously one of the extraordinary contributors to the whole paradigm of functional nutrition and its relationship to neurological activity. With that as an introduction, let me, if I can, presage the comments that you're going to hear from Dr. Pauling in an interview that I had the privilege of doing with him back in the early 1980s when I was a research associate at the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine on sabbatical from my teaching position at the university. This is a historical interview, and I think you'll find it quite interesting to get Dr. Pauling's take in the early 1980s on what the status of affairs was as it pertained to vitamin C and orthomolecular medicine then, and his forecast of what it would be in the future. We'll wait for his own comments to see how good a forecaster he was, but I think you'll find it an extraordinarily prescient discussion. To set the tone, however, before we get into Dr. Pauling's interview, I thought we might go back and just review quickly the history that led up to this extraordinary 1982 interview and later my extraordinary privilege of interviewing Dr. Abram Hoffer in 2008. The theme really derives out of the intellectual soil from the end of the 19th century. If you recall the end of the 19th century in terms of the history of science and medicine, this was a period of time that you had people like Rudolf Virchow, the father of modern pathology, who started moving into understanding the origin of disease as a pathological-based condition and codifying in a systematic way tissue pathology and defining disease as entities related to these pathologies. This was tied together with the development of the concept of human genetics, now resurrecting the discoveries that were made by Gregor Mendel that lay dormant for 100 years when the church really wasn't too excited about the Mendelian genetics getting well understood. And it was rediscovered by Gregory Bateson in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, as a major theme in the connection with inherited traits, and how that interrelated with Charles Darwin at this same period, this epic period of time, the understanding of the nature of evolution and natural selection. All of this tying together to give rise to the birthing of what we consider the modern concept of the origin of disease that was seen in the 20th century. Also, this was the time of origin, really, of systematic organic chemistry with Emil Fischer, the extraordinary German chemist that was starting to help us understand that there wasn't some vitalism in natural molecules, that they were interrelated with molecules that could be seen in the test tube. And the work, as you know, of Wohler on the conversion of cyanate into urea and ultimately the recognition that the inorganic and organic world were connected through chemistry. And this whole concept that vitalism was being put aside and the concept of reductionistic understanding of the milieu of life was starting to emerge. And then as we go from there, we actually recognize that the origin of the age of vitamins started to emerge right at the turn of the century with the discovery of the anti-beriberi factor, as the Eichmann work on thiamine as an agent that could prevent and treat beriberi, the vitamine, the substances that were derived vital amines from food. And, of course, we tie that together with Ely Metchnikoff, working at the Pasteur Institute, who won a Nobel Prize in medicine for his discoveries about the origin of the immune system and later his prolongation of life concept as it relates to the colon as the origin of many diseases through the alteration of the immune system. All of this was happening at the latter portion of the 19th century. It was an epic period for setting new paradigms in place, just as the start of the 21st century has been a similar epic period as we start to look at systems biology and molecular medicine and start to look at the influence of various agents in the environment on genomic expression and the birthing of nutrigenomics, nutriproteomics, nutrimetabolomics, and what we call the trilogy of omics. It's establishing a new way of looking at the origin of dysfunction, metabolic disturbance, and ultimately chronic disease. So this period of change that occurred at the end of the 19th century, moving into the 20th century, also was a period of time where an extraordinary person by the name of Dr. Archibald Garrod, a third-generation medical doctor whose father was really the person who was given credit in discovering the first autoimmune disease, which is gout. His father crystallized on a thread, put in a gout patient's urine, the first crystals of uric acid, which thanks to the birthing of organic chemistry could be analyzed to be seen as uric acid, and from that was born the molecular connection to the first autoimmune disease. This would be during the middle of the 19th century. Dr. Garrod, the son, Archibald, then took these concepts and actually wrote the first textbook on autoimmune disease that was in the English literature back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So Dr. Archibald Garrod then took this concept on even farther, looking at colored compounds in urine. This is the age of the starting of spectroscopy and the understanding of chromophores and how light abstracting compounds that gave rise to color could be used to identify chemical constituents. And colored urine was a very interesting part of the application of this concept of spectroscopy in the late 19th and 20th century. So Dr. Garrod was able to start looking at some of these porphyrias and looking at things that were related to colored compounds in urine and identified then the first genetic metabolism diseases of infancy, that being alkaptonuria. And in fact, interestingly enough, his article that was published originally in The Lancet in 1902, entitled The Incidence of Alkaptonuria, Study in Chemical Individuality, really was the birthing of the whole field of molecular uniqueness, biochemical individuality, and later what we called molecular medicine, which was a term coined by Dr. Linus Pauling. And I think if you go back and read the article by Dr. Garrod in The Lancet in 1902, you would find that many of the things that it describes are as modern today as they were at the turn of the last century. I find it absolutely fascinating that when he looks at the concept of a genetic metabolism disease through the lens of that period of time and his own connection between the chemical world and physiological and medical world, from that emerges a platform for understanding the origin of many diseases that were previously not understood at all. This is what Thomas Kuhn called a paradigm shift, a major shift in thinking. I quote from a part of Dr. Garrod's landmark paper, and he says, quote, "There are good reasons for thinking that alkaptonuria is not the manifestation of a disease, but is rather of the nature of an alternative course of metabolism, harmless and usually congenital and lifelong. Witness is borne to its harmlessness by those who have manifested this peculiarity without any apparent detriment to health from infancy into adult, even into advanced age. However, we can see that those individuals who excrete excess levels of homogentisic acid, these individuals have a unique aspect of metabolism that is controlled by aspects of their family history. End quote. So from that, I would suggest that he is starting to talk very beautifully about the nature of biochemical individuality and how it can express itself into the phenotype over the course of living. Some things are seen in infancy. Other things are seen later in life as it relates to these genetic uniquenesses. And what we might consider to be a genetic defect might actually be defined as a genetic uniqueness, requiring a specific environment in order to minimize the potential adverse effects of that uniqueness or to optimize the positive nature of that genetic uniqueness. Now, I want you to recall when this was written in 1902, this is the age of really the development of molecular genetics and ultimately genetics in medicine. So this was fairly early on in Bateson's argument that we need to look at genes and genetic lineages and look at these dominant recessive characteristics that were originally described in peas through the work of the great monk working in his garden, Gregor Mendel. So from that extraordinary soil, to use the gardening metaphor, of Dr. Girard was born then the germination of this concept of molecular uniqueness and biochemical individuality. As we roll the clock, the hourglass forward, we're led then into the middle 1900s. Now I'm in the 20th century, 1949, with an extraordinary back-to-back series of two papers that appeared in Science magazine. The first is by a gentleman by the name of James Neal, N-E-E-L, who is the chairman, director of the Heredity Clinic, a laboratory of vertebrate biology at the University of Michigan. And this is a paper that appeared in the July 15, 1949 issue of Science Magazine, volume 110, page 64, in which he's talking about the inheritance of a genetic metabolism-related disorder, and that is sickle cell anemia. And so I want you to recall the timeline. We're 50 years downstream now, from where Dr. Girard was talking about the porphyrias and talking about alkaptonuria and other genetic metabolism disorders that could be seen clinically as altered color of urine, with these colored compounds being excreted in the urine as a consequence of different metabolism. And some of these urine compounds, by the way, didn't develop as colored compounds until the urine was exposed to light because they undergo photochemical reactions with these metabolites to produce conjugated compounds that are colored. So this is a whole interesting chapter of evolution of the chemistry connection to medicine and to genetics. So in 1949, James Neal talks about what happens in a drop of blood from a member of the family who has sickle cell anemia, talking about that you get this bizarre clumping of the cells in the sickle or holly leaf shape, and the ability of these erythrocytes to sickle is a phenomena that appears to be attended by no pathological consequences in the majority of these individuals until, and I want to emphasize, they're thrust into some kind of an unusual environment. This could be stress, sleep deprivation, dehydration, physical trauma, infection. And then at that point of stress, this characteristic, this genetic tendency for these blood cells to pack in these unusual ways, these sickling configurations, now can result in a pathological outcome that can be multi-organ involvement. It can be affecting the heart, the circulatory system, the musculature, the liver, the kidneys. So now you get a multiple organ influence from a biochemical uniqueness that's encoded in the genes of these individuals who's triggered into this pathological state by environmental factors. So here's our genes and environment connection that's starting to emerge through the concept of sickle cell anemia. And we recognize these are inherited susceptibility factors. It doesn't mean that a person who has these genes for sickling situations will necessarily be in crisis. What it means is they have an increased susceptibility to certain environmental factors. Well, from that interesting paper published in 1949, the companion paper that followed it is to me one of the most dramatic aha papers that's appeared in the literature, and it comes from the pen of Dr. Linus Pauling working with his postdoctoral student, Dr. Harvey Itano. And this article is entitled Sickle Cell Anemia, a Molecular Disease. And this is the first time, as far as I know, that the term molecular disease was used in the English-speaking literature, following on from Archibald Girard's work, really, that had been done way back when at the turn of the 20th century. And in this particular case, Dr. Pauling, then a professor at California Institute of Technology, developed an extraordinary way of looking at these sickling cells. Being a chemist, he looked at the uniqueness of these red cells and said, what do they have in them that other cells don't have? And of course, all of us know that they have hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is an iron porphyrin molecule, and iron is a ferromagnetic element. It has effects in magnetic fields. And so he was able to demonstrate that there were different spin states of the iron and hemoglobin in the sickle cells versus that were in the normal red cells. And by utilizing a very interesting way of evaluating the effect of cells by a magnetic field, he was able to start differentiating cells that would be sickled versus those not sickled and start looking at the actual chemistry of how this whole process of altered hemoglobin was formed in the sickle cell individual. And eventually, because he was also a protein chemist and very interested in structure function, able to isolate and analyze the protein structure of the beta globulin molecule of hemoglobin and found that there was a single cell substitution mutation. And as a consequence of this mutation of one amino acid for another, that single change in this large chain of amino acids was at a critical point of the structure of that protein, causing that globular protein as part of the hemoglobin molecule to then change the whole structure of hemoglobin to make it more able to be packed into this configuration that led to sickling and ultimately distorting the shape of the whole red cell. Now it looks like a sickle and it cuts its way through the vasculature, causing pathology when it starts packing together. So this concept that a single amino acid change caused by a single gene alteration could lead then into a very serious series of crises and diseases that cut across multiple organs, for which he called this a molecular disease, was a major paradigm shift in thinking about the origin of disease. Recall, if you would, the major theme about the origin of disease to that point was infectious disease, and that was a major, obviously, breakthrough in understanding the origin of disease at the turn of the last century with Louis Pasteur and others, who had really helped us to understand that certain bugs can cause disease through this process of infection and the interrelationship with the immune system and so forth. So from that was later then born this additional concept of the origin of disease, this genetic metabolism disease, where genes and environment interrelate to give rise to the expression of an outcome in the phenotype called a disease, in this case, a sickling crisis. So this follows on nicely, this intellectual lineage, from that of the soil that was first prepared by Archibald Garrod. In that same period of time, in the 1949 period of time, just to show you how there's consanguous concepts of discovery that occur in great epic periods, another well-known figure, the member that we would consider one of the founding fathers of functional medicine, was doing his work, and this is Dr. Roger Williams, who at the time was working as a faculty member at the Clayton Foundation for Research in the Chemistry Department of the University of Texas, where he later was department chairman in Austin, Texas, and was an esteemed biochemist and actually credited with discovering pantothenic acid, and was one of those people who was considered at the top of his game. In fact, had been the president of the American Chemical Society, the professional society for chemists in the United States. And in the same period of time that Dr. Pauling is writing his paper with Dr. Atano on sickle cell anemia, molecular disease, this whole concept of genetic uniquenesses giving rise to single changes in proteins that give rise to the expression under certain environmental conditions of disease, Dr. Williams was then developing his concept of genetotrophic disease. And genetotrophic disease is an extraordinary concept that at the time, I believe, published in 1950 for the first time, in The Lancet. Once again, The Lancet, this was February 11th of 1950, a classic article. And what he goes on to say is that this theme of disease occurring as a consequence of genetic uniqueness and certain nutritional insufficiencies was another part of this paradigm-shifting discovery. And I quote from his paper, he says, based essentially upon recent findings in genetics and biochemistry, which have not yet been incorporated into medical thought, the concept of genetic trophic disease may, we believe, lead to an understanding of many diseases whose etiology is at present obscure, end quote. Now, what is this concept of genetic trophic disease? Well, this is the concept that we each have genetic uniqueness for many things, one of which is the need for specific nutrients to promote proper functional physiology. And if, in fact, those needs that we each individually have based on our genetics is not met, then the result could be dysfunctional metabolism, which over time can lead to disease. And this is very interesting if you think about it for a moment, because it almost goes back to H.P. Heim's work and his work, which was also published in the middle 1900s. You recall he is the head of the endocrinology department, University of London School of Medicine, very highly esteemed director of medical research in England at the time. He is credited as discovering metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. He went on to say, "The history of modern knowledge is concerned in no small degree with man's attempt to escape from his previous concepts," end quote. That's when he was talking about insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia as a different form of diabetes than that of just frank insulin deficiency, what we now later to be called type 1 diabetes. So again, he said the history of modern knowledge is concerned in no small way with man's attempt to escape from his previous concepts, because he had a hard time getting his colleagues to understand there could be a second type of diabetes that was associated not with the deficiency of insulin, but an insufficiency of insulin promoting proper signaling or proper function. So all of this was occurring at the same time, and in fact, Williams quotes Heimsworth when he talks about the paradigm-shifting concept of a genetotrophic disease in this fantastic article that appeared in The Lancet in 1950. And in fact, he even goes on in this article to talk about etiology of diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and arthritis, and other conditions like alcoholism, having their root origin in genetic uniqueness and nutritional insufficiency based upon the individual's own uniqueness that is not being met by their nutritional intake. In fact, in this 1950 article, Dr. Williams also goes on to talk about mental disease and various types of things like schizophrenia may be a result of the inadequacy of specific nutrients to the genetic need of that individual. And he says, and I quote, "There is a prodigious amount of data to indicate combined genetic and nutritional influences in many forms of mental disease that an entire volume might be written on this topic alone. For many years, it's been seen that there are forms of dementia and other nutritional associated symptoms of mental illness that could be tracked back to genetics not being adequately supported by proper nutrition," end quote. So I think that we're witnessing now in the 21st century a revisiting, a rediscovery of these paradigms that were developed really from the work of people like Archibald Garrod and later Dr. Pauling and Dr. Williams. In fact, Dr. Williams takes this concept of genetotrophic disease on to an even more descriptive level in a wonderful review article that he authored in Nutrition Reviews. Actually, this is in September of 1950. This is Volume 8, early on in the first publications of Nutrition Reviews, in which he talks about the extraordinary research that's in the literature that he believes supports the concepts of genetic uniqueness and what he later called biochemical individuality. That takes us up then to 1968. And 1968 is an epic landmark period in the history of our field and this whole nature of functional medicine, because it was that year that Dr. Linus Pauling authored what I consider to be one of the great papers that sat in the literature for many years, probably not understood as well as it should in terms of its impact on the future trajectory of medicine. And this, again, appeared in Science Magazine, April 19, 1968, entitled Orthomolecular Psychiatry: Varying the Concentration of Substances Normally Present in the Human Body May Control Mental Disease, was the subtitle of this particular epic paper. And in this paper, Dr. Pauling talks really at the next level from that of Dr. Williams and genotrophic disease about optimizing molecular concentrations of what he called orthomolecular substances, substances that are native to the human body, and how that then influences enzyme function and how that enzyme function controls and regulates cellular activity in the phenotype of the individual, and how individuals with unique genetics might have enzymes that are slightly different in their structure and function from that of other individuals, and therefore their need for coenzymes to promote proper enzyme function may be slightly higher. This leads to the orthomolecular supplementation concept. Not that they're getting superordinate amounts of supplements, but they're getting the level of nutrients necessary under their unique genes to promote proper enzyme function. This is the application of Le Chatelier's principle. Remember the French chemist that died during the French Revolution, whose concept was you apply stress to an equilibrium and the equilibrium moves in the direction to minimize the stress. That's kind of a metaphor, isn't it, to the French Revolution. But anyway, the chemistry outcome of that is you add more of your substrate and you push that then through the equilibrium dynamics onto more product. And in this case, increasing the activity and amount of a cofactor or coenzyme can promote more of the apoenzyme becoming the haloenzyme, the active enzyme, that then catalyzes that specific reaction. And this is the basis for things like the use of more B12 at hundreds of times the RDI for megaloblastic anemia, or for the use of more B6 and folate for people with homocysteemia. This is the specific applications of these conceptual framework that Dr. Pauling was speaking to. You can't change the genes, but you can change the environment that would then promote proper enzyme function. This concept that is described in Orthomolecular Psychiatry, this landmark paper, then leads us into a period of nearly 40 years of debate and controversy and up and down and, you know, what does this really mean? And it really led us into a moment in time that I think is one of those aha moments, which was the publication in 2002 of a review paper by Bruce Ames and Ilson Schwab and Eli Silver. This paper appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 75, page 616 in 2002. And the title of this paper is High-Dose Vitamin Therapy Stimulating Variant Enzymes with Decreased Coenzyme Binding Affinity, Relevance to Genetic Disease and Polymorphisms. This is the review paper that was necessary to be written by a scholar such as Dr. Ames, an icon in the field, to help to support this whole lineage of the development of this theme since Archibald Garrod to Roger Williams and into Linus Pauling. In this review paper, which has 377 references, Dr. Ames and his co-authors do a brilliant job of really supporting this concept of genetotrophic disease, orthomolecular medicine, and molecular medicine as it pertains to the role that nutritional supplements can have in specific cases for promoting proper function. In fact, in this paper, he goes on to say, as many as one-third of mutations in a gene result in the corresponding enzyme having an increase in the Kallis constant. This means decreased binding affinity for its respective coenzyme, which is generally a vitamin-derived. This results in a lower rate of reaction. About 50 human genetic diseases due to defective enzymes can be remediated or ameliorated by the administration, he says, of high doses of vitamin components of the corresponding coenzyme, which at least partially restores enzymatic activity. He then talks about single nucleotide polymorphisms in which the variant amino acid reduces coenzyme binding and thus enzymatic activity. And these can be remediable by raising cellular concentrations of the cofactor, the very concept that Linus Pauling discussed in 1968 in his Science article. He goes on then to talk about many, many examples of this and many applications of this clinically that have been proven in the literature. And with 377 references, anyone that says there's no science needs to do their homework. So that leads us now into the 21st century with this whole development of nutrigenomics and nutriproteomics and nutrimetabolomics and how this then really relates to individual need for nutrients to promote individual function. It ties to the vitamin C controversy. It ties to all the things that we have seen debated, including the niacin and schizophrenia controversy and the B6 and folate controversy to homocysteemia, all the things that are still being debated today. With that, let's go to the father of this whole concept, Dr. Linus Pauling, and hear what he had to say in 1982.
Hello, I'm Dr. Jeff Bland. I'm a senior research fellow at the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine, and it's a great pleasure today to be with Dr. Linus Pauling, the chairman of the board and the chief visionary influence on the Linus Pauling Institute's activities. I'm here today to really engage in a fireside chat with Dr. Pauling to discuss some of the areas of his interest and some of his research progress that he's making, and hopefully acquaint you with some of the things that are not only going on here at the Institute, but in the field of science and healthcare in general. So let me thank Dr. Pauling very much for being with us today and for sharing this moment of his precious time. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Pauling.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to start, if I could, just for the sake of the listeners, asking you if you might review for us some of your recent activities. I know you've been traveling all around and you've been speaking to many groups. I'm sure we'd all like to hear some of the things that have occupied your time.
Well, you know, I divide my time, it turns out, into thirds. one-third of the time I work on basic problems of science, which I've been interested in for a long time, since 1922 when I carried out my first research. So I still make quantum mechanical calculations about molecular structures and crystal structure, the nature of metals, and the structure of nuclei. Then one-third of my time is devoted to collaborating with other people here in the Linus Pauling Institute in our attack on medical problems. Right now, we are just finishing up a big study of the effectiveness of vitamin C in controlling cancer in mice. It's turned out, I'm glad to say, that the vitamin C has great value. It slows down greatly the development of spontaneous breast cancer in a strain of mice that develop these cancers. I collaborate with many people in the Institute in their researches, in considerable part by talking with them about what they are doing and giving them advice, perhaps, or making suggestions on the basis of my years of experience. The job of answering letters from people who write in for advice is a considerable one that takes up a good bit of my time. Then, the other third of my time, I travel. I travel to give talks largely about vitamins and health, or about health in general, especially in relation to nutrition. Some of them about world peace, because why should I be working on improving the health of people if the world is going to be destroyed in a great nuclear war? We need to have a future, to believe that we are going to have a future, that the human race will have a future, in order to justify our trying to control cancer and heart disease and other diseases. And of course, some of the talks that I give on these trips that I take are about science.
I'd like, if I could, to sort of switch the topic and ask you, you alluded to this exciting study here at the Institute that's been ongoing for a couple of years as it relates to vitamin C's impact upon spontaneous mammary cancer in mice, and that's but one of a number of exciting types of work that are going on in the Institute. I'm sure that our listeners would like to hear a little bit more about some of the other things happening at the Institute. Could you say a few words about that?
Well, some of the investigators in the Institute are working on the question of just what is cancer? How does cancer originate in the human body? During recent years, the last 20 years, it has been possible to get information about genetic influences, about the role of genes, which are polynucleotides, DNA strings of DNA molecules, in causing cancer and in achieving almost everything else that goes on in the human body. So our investigators have been involved in the recent work on oncogenes. Oncogenes are genes that are involved in cancer, and they are closely related to genes that are present in every human being or in every animal of the species under study. When one of these pro-oncogenes, a gene that might become an oncogene, undergoes a genetic mutation, it becomes an oncogene, a gene that changes the nature of the organism in such a way that a cancer develops, or there may be some second effect that also must occur. More than one change is usually involved in the production of cancer. So this very modern technique of studying the DNA molecules that determine the nature of an individual human being, including the cancers that he might produce, is being used by workers, investigators in our institute. A different attack is being made by Dr. Constance Tsao and her associates. This is to study certain chemical substances that are produced by oxidation of vitamin C. It was discovered 10 or 15 years ago by Dr. Omura, well, in fact, by his teacher, but he who then retired, and Dr. Omura has continued, that oxidation products of vitamin C, which are formed in the human body after vitamin C is ingested, have greater anti-cancer activity in animals than vitamin C itself has. This hasn't been followed up by anyone. There are a number of these oxidation products, different substances that you get by a reaction of vitamin C and oxygen. We don't know whether all of them have a greater anti-cancer activity than vitamin C, or only one or two of them. And we don't understand at all how they work in controlling cancer. It may turn out that much of the anti-cancer activity of vitamin C results from its oxidation in the human body to these oxidation products. So I have hope that this will turn out to be a really significant effort that will lead to an advance in our ability to control cancer. Vitamin C itself, of course, works in other ways than just through the oxidation products. It is required for the efficient operation of the immune system. We know that when the immune system is functioning well, the probability of dying from cancer is less than when the immune system is not functioning well. After an operation for removal of a cancer, in almost every patient, there are in the bloodstream millions of malignant cells. And yet only some of these patients then later develop metastatic cancer. Others do not. Why? It is believed, and I think quite rightly, that if your immune system is working well, then that system can detect the malignant cells, prepare them for destruction, and then carry out their destruction. And so in the people who have a well-working immune system, the malignant cells are destroyed and metastases do not occur. Vitamin C is known to potentiate the immune system in various ways. An English investigator named Balance showed that more antibodies that can identify the malignant cells are formed with a high intake of vitamin C than with a low intake. More molecules of complement are formed as a result of additional vitamin C. Molecules of complement have to attach themselves to the complex of a malignant cell or group of malignant cells and antibodies in order that these malignant cells be destroyed. So with a high intake of vitamin C, you produce more of the T lymphocytes that can destroy these marked malignant cells, the complex of the antibodies complement and the malignant cells. And it's been known for 40 years now, more than 40 years, and nearly 50 years, that vitamin C is required in these T lymphocytes, in phagocytes, in white cells generally, in order that they be able to destroy infected cells and malignant cells. Vitamin C is intimately involved in the process of protecting the human body against infections and against malignancies, because the only way the human body has of destroying these infected cells and malignant cells is with use of vitamin C. So vitamin C is important to cancer in many ways. Well, now we are just embarking on a new project that I am especially interested in. This is vitamin C in relation to heart disease. Evidence has been turning up during recent years about the involvement of vitamin C in heart disease. There is a good correlation between incidence of heart disease and the amount of cholesterol in the body, and also the amount of low-density lipoprotein. This low-density lipoprotein is the protein consists of molecules that can carry cholesterol molecules out to cells in the body where they are required for proper functioning of the cells. Cholesterol is a very important substance. Sometimes, however, the amount of cholesterol is too great and it gets involved in laying down plaques in the blood vessels. There's another protein, a lipoprotein, whose molecules have the function of picking up cholesterol and carrying it back to the organs where it is destroyed and the liver converted into bile acids that are then eliminated from the body. Well, vitamin C has been shown to speed up the rate of conversion of cholesterol to bile acids. And that means you're bleeding off the cholesterol so that the level in the body goes down. It has also been shown to cause the production of more high-density lipoprotein. That means you have more of the protein that removes cholesterol from the blood vessels and carries it to the liver to be destroyed. Also, it cuts down, slows down the rate of production of low-density lipoprotein so that you have a smaller number of the molecules that carry the cholesterol out to the blood vessels where the plaques can be formed. It also cuts down the amount of triglycerides in the blood, and there's a correlation between triglycerides and heart attacks. So with all of these correlations, we can see cutting down the total cholesterol, the low-density lipoprotein, and the triglycerides, and increasing the high-density lipoprotein, and speeding up the rate of destruction of the cholesterol, converting it to bile acids. We can see that vitamin C might well be correlated in a very striking way with heart disease. A high intake of vitamin C may turn out to be the best way of protecting yourself against heart disease. Our epidemiological associate, Dr. James Enstrom, has published a paper describing a study that he made of several hundred people who had been ingesting larger amounts of vitamin C than the population as a whole. On the average, about a gram and a half, 1,500 milligrams of vitamin C. And they had only about half the probability of dying of heart disease at each age as the control population, similar subpopulations in California, who were on an ordinary diet with an ordinary intake of vitamin C. There are other differences between the two populations that he compared, but it seems likely that this high intake of vitamin C is largely responsible for their having half as much mortality from heart disease, age-standardized, age-corrected mortality. Well, they had only half as much mortality from cancer, too, and from other diseases. Vitamin C is not a specific remedy, a wonder drug against cancer or against the common cold or against the flu or hepatitis or viral pneumonia or herpes infections or heart disease. It's not a specific wonder drug. What it does is to build up the human body to the state of health that all human beings ought to be in. When I read what the Food and Nutrition Board says, that 60 milligrams of vitamin C a day is enough for all persons in ordinary good health, I think they should say all persons in ordinary poor health. If you want to be in what ought to be ordinary good health, you have to take additional vitamin C. Of course, I believe that the arguments that support this conclusion are really thoroughly convincing. They are the sort of arguments that appeal to me as a scientist. I am accustomed to looking at the facts and trying to draw some logical conclusions from them. Other people perhaps are not so accustomed to doing that. I would say that the evidence that high intake, many times the usually recommended amount, the RDA, of vitamin C, is needed for good health, that conclusion is thoroughly justified by the evidence.
I'd like to respond and say that this relationship between vitamin C and heart disease is a very interesting controversy recently in the literature that I believe falls right in line with what you're talking about, that some people interpret data differently. There was a report in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition by some supposed responsible investigators saying that vitamin C did not increase high-density lipoprotein cholesterol and did not lower total cholesterol. However, in examining the protocol of the study, it was found that the average starting cholesterol of this group was about three-quarters the value of the standard average American cholesterol level, meaning it was about 175, where the normal value is about 220 for the average person. And it had already been pointed out in 1976 through another series of investigations that vitamin C is most effective in lowering cholesterol and raising HDL when a person has an elevated blood cholesterol level, meaning that the study population selected in this study was already almost guaranteed to show a negative result, which I found to be something that was either naivete on the part of the investigators or more likely that they were trying to make a certain polemical statement through the misuse of science.
Yes, it is true that if you want to find out what some investigators have observed, you have to go back and read their entire paper, not just read a statement that someone has made, even the investigators themselves have made, about what results they have obtained. So that people are often misled by statements that some investigator showed that this substance did not have any value, when in fact he had observed some value, but not so great as he had expected to observe, or when the number of subjects was so small that he was not able to show with statistical significance that there was a positive effect. Very often the mistake is made that when an investigator has used a certain number of subjects, which might be rather small, and has failed to show benefit from the treatment at what is considered a statistically significant level, the results are described as his having shown that there was no effect, when in fact he hadn't shown that there was no effect. He had just not succeeded in showing that there was an effect. And the statistical treatment that you give if you are trying to answer these two questions is quite different.
One of the most common questions, Dr. Pauling, that the average person asks about vitamin C therapy, particularly today in light of a lot of the published information in the wire service and in magazines and newspapers, is surrounding vitamin C's supposed toxic effects. And I think that there are several notable reports that have occurred in the literature lately. I know you responded very eloquently to a paper that appeared in Seminars in Oncology recently by Dr. Mary Sestelli, who's commented that vitamin C has toxic effects potentially when used in cancer therapy. And you've also previously responded to Dr. Victor Herbert, a hematologist, who says that vitamin C supplementation may destroy vitamin B12. We also hear that Vitamin C supplementation supposedly causes kidney stones through its metabolism to oxalate. And recently there has been the report by a Professor Cherlewski at Oregon State University that somehow vitamin C supplement causes an antagonism of copper metabolism in the body and leads to copper deficiency anemia. I think it'd be very useful for our listeners to sort of put this into perspective. Could you comment on vitamin C's toxicity for us?
Well, human beings differ from one another. There may well be a few human beings who should not take very large doses of vitamin C, but they are so rare, in my opinion, that it's justified for me to say that vitamin C is essentially completely non-toxic. Some of the arguments that have been presented are based on a misunderstanding. We know that the common sort of kidney stone has a greater tendency to form in alkaline urine than in acidic urine, but uncommon forms have a greater tendency to form in acidic union. When my book, Vitamin C and the Common Cold, came out, it was immediately attacked in a publication, mainly for doctors. The statement was made that vitamin C in the form of ascorbic acid keeps the urine acidic and so increases the tendency to form certain kinds of kidney stones, the less common kinds. Well, that is true, but it isn't an effect of vitamin C. Vitamin C is the ascorbate ion. You can't take pure vitamin C because you can't get hold of a large aggregate of negatively charged ions. There always is a positive ion along with them. And that can be either hydrogen ion or sodium ion or calcium ion or some other ion. Ordinary vitamin C tablets contain ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C with hydrogen ion, and they make the urine acidic. It isn't the vitamin C, then, that increases the tendency to form these uncommon stones. It's the hydrogen ion that you're taking along with the ascorbate ion. But to keep the urine acidic decreases the tendency to form the common stones. If you know, not many people form stones anyway, but fewer still know what kind they might have a tendency to form. If you happen to know that you have a tendency to form common kidney stones, then you would be wise to take ascorbic acid, vitamin C in the form of ascorbic acid, the common way in which it's available, or to take some other acidifying agent. But ascorbic acid is the best thing to take to cut down the chance of forming the common kidney stones. If you know, if you have formed one of the uncommon kind, then the doctor may well advise you to keep the urine alkaline. You could take baking soda as an alkalinizing agent, or you can take sodium ascorbate. And when you take sodium ascorbate, you are not only protecting yourself to some extent against forming additional kidney stones of that uncommon kind, but you are also benefiting from the vitamin C. With the oxalate stones, there may be one person described in the medical literature as having an oxalate stone formed because of the large volume amount of vitamin C that he took. That's possibly a real effect for that person of a special genotype. The number of these cases is so small that I don't think that is a reason not to take vitamin C. Now, for some of these other statements, Dr. Victor Herbert saying that vitamin C destroys vitamin B12 and you may get pernicious anemia was based on an error that he and his associate made when they analyzed their foods for vitamin B12. They just didn't use the standard procedure for making the analysis for vitamin B12. And when other investigators repeated their work, when they used Dr. Herbert's method, they got the same results he had got. But when they used the standard method, they found that practically none of vitamin B12 had been destroyed. Only a small amount of loosely bound vitamin B12 had been destroyed, so that the statement that vitamin C can cause pernicious anemia or B12 deficiency anemia is just not in accordance with the facts. It was based on an error. With the investigator in Oregon State University, Dr. Chernuski, who reported that the copper level in the blood went down when the subjects were given large doses of vitamin C, the situation has been exacerbated by a writer in the popular newspapers who misrepresented Dr. Chernuski's work. First, he said that Dr. Chernuski took the subjects off the vitamin C after 60 days or whatever period in order to protect them from dying of anemia. Dr. Chernuski says this just isn't true. He said that in his paper, he mentioned the possibility that this lower copper level would lead to an iron deficiency anemia, to the failure to incorporate iron in the red blood cells, in the hemoglobin for the red blood cells. But he didn't think that it would occur. He just mentioned that as a possibility. So the scare statements that you'll get anemia, die of anemia, if you take large doses of vitamin C, are not justified by the statements of the investigator himself. Vitamin C improves the workings of the human body so much that it may well be that people will produce as much hemoglobin as they need, even though their copper levels are somewhat less than in other people or when they are on a smaller intake of vitamin C. So there's no evidence really to support that conclusion about vitamin C and anemia. The same thing is true for many other statements that are made about possible dangers of vitamin C, one of which is that if you take large doses of vitamin C and then stop, you will develop scurvy. Or if a mother, pregnant woman, takes large doses, the child is apt to have a special need for vitamin C such that the child will be scorbutic on the ordinary intake of vitamin C that would not permit scurvy to develop. There just is no evidence to support this. There is a rebound effect, which in fact was discovered 10 years ago by my associates and me. It's a rebound effect that occurs after you have been taking large doses of vitamin C and stop suddenly. The level in the blood goes below that corresponding to the ordinary low intake, and it stays low for a few days. I recommend that people taper off if they want to stop a large dose instead of stopping. But Dr. Anderson in Toronto carried out a study in which he checked whether people have increased probability of developing the common cold, respiratory illness, during this period after they've stopped a large intake than they have ordinarily on the ordinary low intake. And he found he couldn't detect any increased incidence of respiratory illness during this period when the level in the blood is lower than usual. So there is an effect. It's not an important effect. Nevertheless, I suggest that people should taper off over a period of a week or two if they have been taking large doses. And then I say, but better still, don't stop the large doses. If you go to the hospital, if a patient goes to the hospital, a person who has been taking supplementary vitamins, the doctor is apt to stop the supplementary vitamins. This is wrong. The doctors should be giving larger amounts of vitamin C and other vitamins to patients in hospitals. You know, here we're troubled about the fact that the cost of medical care in the United States is very high. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on medical care, hospital care, $600, $700, $800 a day for patients in the hospital. It's been known for 40 years that you can cut down the length of stay in the hospital by 2 or 3 or 4 days, or by 30 or 40 or 50% for a longer stay, if the patient receives large amounts of vitamin C. After a surgical operation, the wounds heal faster with vitamin C. It's been known for about 50 years that vitamin C is required for wound healing. You can't manufacture collagen, connective tissue, scar tissue. You just can't heal wounds if you don't have vitamin C. When a person not getting vitamin C begins to die of scurvy, if he has an old scar, it's apt to break open again because he's not manufacturing collagen. And in fact, his joints fall apart, his blood vessels burst because he's not making the collagen which is required for the strength of these organs and tissues. And vitamin C is needed, absolutely needed, to make collagen. So your body is stronger when you take vitamin C. Now, about what my associates are doing. Dr. Cameron, when he first gave large doses of vitamin C to terminal cancer patients in Scotland, and he deserves credit for having discovered by his clinical observations that vitamin C really has value for cancer patients, one of the things that Dr. Cameron noticed was that the patients said, "Doctor, I feel so strong." They not only didn't feel sick, have this cachexia, just feeling miserable, that's characteristic of cancer, and not only developed good appetites instead of being anorectic, not able to eat because the food didn't taste good, but they also got strong. Dr. Cameron wondered, what can vitamin C be doing that makes the patient say that they feel strong? And they were strong. He mentions that one of his patients in Scotland, liked to play golf, was able to lower his golf score after he got out of the hospital. And another retired man took on the job of chopping wood, not as a job, but just because he liked doing it. He felt strong, and he brought chopped wood around to Dr. Cameron and other people. Also, Cameron noticed that in the accounts of scurvy, when sailors used to die on ships with scurvy, the first sign of the scurvy was lassitude and lack of muscular strength. And then the body began falling apart. Later, the gums ulcerated and the teeth fell out and the joints and so on, and the person died. Well, what about this lack of muscular strength and regaining strength in Cameron's patients? There's a simple chemical substance named carnitine, which is present in muscle juice to the extent of about 1%. If you squeeze meat, the juice that you get out contains carnitine. Carnitine is required for muscular activity. You know, you burn fuel in the body to provide the energy for muscular work. And this is burned in the cells, in the muscle. The fuel that you burn is fat, at least one of the fuels. Carnitine is required to carry molecules of fat into these cells where they can be burned to provide muscular energy. Just a couple of years ago, a biochemist showed that carnitine can be made from lysine, an amino acid present in the body and present in meat too, lysine, by chemical reactions that take place in the human body, catalyzed by certain enzymes, two of which are hydroxylation reactions that require vitamin C. You can't make carnitine from lysine without vitamin C. The fact that people sometimes say, "I have to eat red meat to be strong," may be that they are getting carnitine from the meat and that helps them to be strong. Or also getting lysine, which is present in larger amounts in meat protein than in vegetable protein. And if they have enough vitamin C, they can convert the lysine to carnitine and thus have even greater muscular strength. So one of the investigations that we are carrying out as a result of the various observations by Dr. Cameron and by others is to study human beings. How much carnitine is in their bodies? How much is floating around in the blood? And if you give a person extra lysine and extra vitamin C, does he then produce more carnitine and become stronger too?
Dr. Pauling, one of the other very commonly asked questions surrounding vitamin C's use in supplemental doses has to do with another antioxidant, knowing that vitamin C is considered a biological antioxidant that works in the water-soluble portion of cells. This other antioxidant is the trace element selenium, which is receiving quite a bit of attention recently because it's supposedly a cancer-preventive nutrient. It's been suggested by Dr. Walter Mertz at the USDA that high-dose vitamin C therapy antagonizes selenium status, or at least prevents selenium absorption from the diet. Do you have any comments on that relationship?
Well, I'm not sure that my comments are as significant as those that you would make. I would think that selenate or selenite might well be reduced to elementary selenium by ascorbate, that selenium in an organic molecule such as selenomethionine or some other organic compound would probably not be affected by the ascorbate. But I'd be interested to know your opinion on this point.
I concur with your comment. In fact, the paper in which the oxidation reduction relationships between inorganic selenium as selenite, selenate, and selenous acid in vitamin C and the organoselenium as selenomethionine, selenocysteine confirmed exactly what you just pointed out, and that is that there was not a reduction in the organic forms of selenium to selenium metal where there was in the inorganic selenite, selenate form. So it would seem to me that if you were supplementing with a sodium selenite preparation and taking high-dose vitamin C, that you may render some of the selenium unabsorbable, but if you were taking the organically bound form, it would be a very small probability reaction.
Yeah, and of course, in the organically bound form, probably is selenium minus one already as far reduced as possible so that the ascorbate couldn't reduce it any further.
Exactly right. One of the other things quickly that you might want to comment on is the suggestion that you can utilize a fat-soluble form of ascorbate called ascorbyl palmitate, where the ascorbic acid molecule is esterified to palmitic acid, and that this is supposedly a very useful antioxidant in the fat-soluble milieu of cells, that you should be taking a supplement of ascorbyl palmitate. Do you have any comment on that?
I would need to be convinced that that fat-soluble form of ascorbate, if we are taking enough of the fat-soluble antioxidant vitamin E. So my recommendation would be to spend your money on vitamin E and save money by buying the cheap form of vitamin C rather than to buy a more expensive form of vitamin C. Moreover, I don't think anyone should rely entirely on this fat-soluble form. It might be taken as an adjunct to a good amount of ascorbate itself, ascorbic acid or sodium ascorbate or calcium ascorbate itself.
What dosage level would be considered for the average consumer who is reasonably well, let's say not sick? What dosage level of vitamin C would be considered at a range that they would have concern about excessive intake? Is there some range that we might say for the average person would be in the desirable range?
Well, vitamin C isn't very expensive. What I buy costs about a cent and a half a gram, the ascorbic acid crystals, and the 1 gram tablets you can get for around 3 cents a tablet, 3 cents a gram. So it isn't very expensive. My 12 grams a day comes to about 18 cents a day. Nevertheless, people may not want to spend too much money on vitamins. I say a little extra vitamin C does a lot of good. To take even 250 or 500 milligrams does a lot of good. To take 1,000 milligrams a day does more good. To take 5,000, 10,000 milligrams, still more good. But in general, I don't complain about a person's telling me that he takes 2,000 milligrams a day. As people get older, I think it would be wise for them to increase the intake. I've already mentioned, I think the 12,000 milligrams that I take is probably the right physiological amount. You can get along pretty well with a somewhat smaller amount. I think that's the right one. Now, a person can find his own upper limit from the gastrointestinal response that was observed 10 years ago by Dr. Cameron and more recently by Dr. Cathcart. Dr. Cameron observed that a sick person can take much larger amounts of vitamin C by mouth without its acting as a laxative or having too much of a laxative effect, producing looseness of the bowels, than the same person when he gets well. Consequently, it might be good for a person to find out what his gastrointestinal limit is, and if it's unusually high, it may well mean that he has a special need for vitamin C, that he is really not in the best of health. I can take only about 12 grams a day. Well, I could take more if I split it up into a succession of small doses, but not much more. Some people can take 20 or 30 grams a day before they get this response, even though they consider that they are in good health. A really sick person, Dr. Cathcart reported, might have to take as much as 200 grams in a day to get this response. But he can't do that day after day. In a few days he's well if he has mononucleosis or hepatitis, some such disease, and has had to cut down his intake. This man who comes to see me every few months, the chemist down in San Jose, still has metastatic cancer. And it's clear that he is not well, both because you can see the metastases when he has CAT scans made, also because he can take his 130 grams a day without having far too much looseness of the bowels. So he's not well. He's able to work to stay alive now for 8 years, but he hasn't been able to get rid of the cancer and get back into good health. Some people do apparently succeed in that.
I know that the listeners would probably like this to go on indefinitely, but we certainly have to recognize that you have many, many other responsibilities today, and we appreciate your time. I would like, however, to leave with one last question being put to you before we have a chance to get together to do this in the future, and that is, I think a lot of people see the rate of change of information occurring and the how quickly science is evolving and developing, and we all probably feel a little bit of a state of overwhelm. As a visionary, as a person who has been a major contributor to the field of science and healthcare and had your finger on the pulse of what's been happening for 70 plus years, what is your vision as to what's occurring right now and a future that you see for healthcare?
I think that it will be recognized before long that the greatest contribution to medicine made in the last quarter of the 20th century is the recognition that nutrition, including nutritional supplements, can be used in a far more effective way to improve health, prevent disease, and even in the treatment of disease, usually as an adjunct to conventional therapy, than had been possible, than it had been used in the past. And in particular, I think vitamin C, which is unique among the vitamins in two or three respects, will be found to have very great value. The estimate that I have made about the value of nutritional supplements, vitamin C, and some other health practices has been increasing. That is, the value of my estimate of the value has been getting greater year after year. So that in an article that I wrote recently, I made the estimate that in this way it should be possible to increase the length of the period of well-being and the length of life by 35 years, which would mean around 110 years as life expectancy rather than 75 years. And this, I feel, is desirable. There are periods in life when you are miserable. When you are young, you are miserable. At least I was miserable before I found the proper relationship to the world as a whole, to the opposite sex, and so on. I was not happy as a child. I was a teenager. I was miserable. And I expect that there may well be a period of misery associated with the decline in health that culminates in death. Maybe that this can be shortened, this second period of misery. The first, I think, has got worse in the last 20 years with the relaxation of the social pressures on young people to behave that kept them from getting involved with problems so intimately that they are, as they are now, involved. So I believe that we can then increase the length of the period of well-being with respect to the period of less well-being. That is, we'll win out in this way by being happier over a greater fraction of our lives than at the present time.
The December 2009 edition of Functional Medicine Update will continue on Part 2. This is the end of Part 1.